content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, Joe and Teresa Graydon. Can you get enough vitamin D from the sun? Question. I've heard that sun exposure might be better than pills for getting vitamin D. How much time do you need in the sun without sunscreen to get a good dose? Answer. A lot depends on your geography, the time of year, time of day, and the shade of your skin. Someone with fair skin can get adequate vitamin D from about 3 weekly sessions of 15 to 20 minutes in the summertime. If you are in a northern locale, you might need twice that. People with darker skin need more time in the sun to make the same amount of vitamin D. Most skin doctors warn that any sun exposure without sunscreen is hazardous. Question. I have been using the pectin grape juice remedy for joint pain, and it is helping. I have a question about the formula. If I cannot find liquid Certo, C-E-R-T-O, can I use the same measurement for powdered pectin? In other words, is a tablespoon of dry pectin the same dose as a tablespoon of liquid Certo? Answer. The proper quantities of these forms of pectin differ from making jams and jellies. Consequently, we suspect they also would be different for this home remedy to ease painful joints. It appears that 2 teaspoons of Pomona's Universal Pectin powdered will gel approximately the same quantity of fruit as 1 pouch of liquid Certo. Each pouch contains 3 fluid ounces or 6 tablespoons. This means that one third teaspoon of powdered pectin would be about equivalent to a tablespoon of liquid pectin. Question. Are pecans heart healthy? I understand that nuts are good for you, but people mostly mention almonds and walnuts. I live in Texas, where pecans are by far the most common nut, and they are also my favorite. Answer. You'll be happy to learn that pecans, like other tree nuts, are beneficial, cited in the Nutrition Journal, June 28, 2015. Scientists analyzed data from more than 14,000 Americans and found that people who ate at least 1/4 ounce of almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, hazelnuts, macadamias, pecans, pine nuts, pistachios, or walnuts daily were leaner, had lower blood pressure, less insulin resistance, and higher HDL or good cholesterol. An experiment in 26 overweight people ran for 12 weeks and compared a diet in which 15% of calories came from pecans with a control diet similar to what Americans usually eat. And that's cited in Nutrients, March 11, 2018. After a month of a pecan-rich diet, these individuals had lower insulin resistance and less insulin in their blood. Post-colonoscopy problems cleared up by antibiotic. Question. I recently read about a 60-year-old man having problems after colonoscopy. I had similar trouble with alternating diarrhea and constipation, as well as a lot of pain that the doctor called irritable bowel syndrome. I put up with the pain and mess for about 5 years. Then I got a cut on my arm while I was working on a construction site. It became infected, and the doctor gave me a broad-spectrum antibiotic. The day I took the last dose of the antibiotic, my bowel problems cleared up and did not return. Apparently, I had picked up a stubborn infection from the colostomy. Answer. Colonoscopes can sometimes be contaminated, cited in the American Journal of Infection Control, August 2015. Another possibility is that the cleansing of the digestive tract in preparation for the colonoscopy disrupted the balance of microbes in your digestive tract, cited in the European Journal of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, May 2016. The impact of antibiotics on the microbes living in the digestive tract is not yet well understood, cited in the journal Cell, C-E-L-L, September 6, 2018. Often antibiotics kill gut microbes indiscriminately, and people sometimes have trouble reestablishing their original ecological balance. However, It sounds as though your antibiotic experience was far more positive. Question. I began using the authorized generic of Celebrex from Greenstone about 2 years ago and noticed a marked difference from taking ordinary generic celecoxib. Now I've been told that Greenstone is no longer producing this authorized generic. Do you have any suggestions on where I can obtain the authorized generic for Celebrex? I am looking for a 100 milligram dose. Answer, Greenstone is a subsidiary of Pfizer. As a result, the generic drug maker distributes a number of authorized generic versions of Pfizer brand name medications. An authorized generic is one licensed by the brand name maker. It is made to the exact same recipe. Consequently, most people report reacting to the authorized generic drug the same way they respond to its brand name counterpart. We have heard from many other readers that they were disappointed with some of the generic versions of Celecoxib. They say they don't get the same pain relief that they got from Celebrex. Greenstone still offers authorized generic Celecoxib in a range of doses. Your pharmacist may have to special order them, however. Prices of drugs to go in TV ads soon. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The Trump administration completed its rule requiring drug makers to include list prices for most drugs in television ads, pushing ahead with efforts to improve transparency in the health care costs, despite oppositions from pharmaceutical companies. The administration's new rule, set to take effect this summer, applies to direct-to-consumer TV advertisements for prescription drugs covered by Medicare or Medicaid. Drug makers must include the wholesale acquisition cost or list price if it is equal to or greater than $35 for a month's supply, and must post the list price at the end of the ad in a way that it can be seen clearly. Drug companies have to come clean about their prices in TV ads, President Trump wrote on Twitter. In 2017, more than $5.5 billion was spent on prescription drug advertising, including nearly $4.2 billion on TV ads. Commonly advertised drugs include AbbVie, A-B-B-V-I-E, Inc.'s Humira, which has a list price of more than $5,000 a month, along with Pfizer, Inc.'s Lyrica, which costs $468 a month, according to data provided in the rule. The rule will go into effect 60 days after it posts in the Federal Register, which is expected to occur, recently. Drug makers have opposed the mandate, saying the rule could improperly limit free speech and that providing only the list price would confuse and mislead consumers who might think they have to pay more than they actually would. The list price is the figure initially set by the drug maker, but it is different than what consumers generally pay because it doesn't take into account rebates, discounts, and insurance payments. While we are still reviewing the administration's rule, we believe there are operational challenges, particularly the 60-day implementation time frame, and think the final rule raises First Amendment and statutory concerns, said Stephen Ubel, UBL, chief executive of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, in a written statement. Pharma is an industry trade group. The administration argued that list prices matter to patients, especially consumers with high deductibles who often must pay the full amount. The U.S. currently requires ads to disclose side effects and other information. Regarding the inclusion of drugs, list prices, and TV ads, or requiring the inclusion of drugs, list prices, and TV ads is the single most significant step any administration has taken toward a simple commitment. American patients deserve to know the prices of health care they receive, said Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. We think it's a fundamental right to know a drug's list price. Matt Ailes, E-Y-L-E-S, president and chief executive of America's Health Insurance Plans, a trade group for the industry, said greater transparency for manufacturers into drug prices, how drug makers set those prices, and why they increase prices on the exact same product year after year is essential to bringing down drug prices. The rule issued recently by HHS, Health and Human Services, is part of a broader effort launched by the White House in May 2018 to combat rising drug prices, an issue many consumers rank as a top health care concern in polls. Virus therapy saves patient with an antibiotic-resistant infection, from the Wall Street Journal. Researchers said they treated a 15-year-old patient's antibiotic-resistant infection with the help of genetically engineered viruses. The effort points to a potential path for countering the growing threat of bacteria resistance to antibiotics. The researchers in the United States and the United Kingdom saved the patient with the help of bacteria-destroying viruses known as bacteriophages that occur naturally in our most populous organisms on the planet. Using genetic engineering, the researchers tweaked some of the phages to specifically fight the patient's infection. The effort, published recently in the journal Nature Medicine, marked the first reported use of a genetically engineered phages to treat a patient, researchers said. The success suggests promise for using engineered phages more broadly against antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We have to be cautiously optimistic about clinically individual cases, says Helen Spencer, a pediatric respiratory consultant at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London, who treated the patient. But I think in terms of globally what we're facing in terms of antibiotic resistance, this could be a really important therapy. Antibiotic resistance is a growing threat across the globe, as overuse of antibiotics in hospitals and in farm animals has made some bacteria resistant and increasingly dangerous, said Helen Boucher, an infectious disease specialist at the Tufts Medical Center in Boston. About 23,000 people die from drug-resistant infections in the U.S. each year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And drug-resistant infections could kill as many as 10 million people a year by 2050. Clinicians first started experimenting with phage therapy to treat bacterial infections as early as 1919, though it fell out of practice in the West after the widespread introduction of antibiotics. The therapy has remained in use in some countries in Eastern Europe and now the former Soviet Union. Now researchers in Western countries are once again exploring phage therapy as bacteria become increasingly resistant to classic antibiotics and new antibiotics are slow to enter the market. Academic institutions, biotech companies, and clinical trials with a focus on bacteriophages are popping up across the United States, and a handful of patients have been successfully treated with the experimental therapy. The 15-year-old patient who had cystic fibrosis had been taking antibiotics for 8 years to fight off two persistent strains of bacteria. After a lung transplant for her cystic fibrosis, however, the infection spread and stopped responding to antibiotics. As a result, the girl's liver lost function. She stopped eating and drinking and had viable lesions on her skin, or had visible lesions on her skin. Looking for new options to treat the patient, Dr. Spencer turned to phage therapy. She partnered with a team at the University of Pittsburgh that had amassed a library of over 15,000 different phages from across the world in order to find one that would attack the patient's infections. The team focused their search on 1,800 phages, both that matched the type of bacteria of the patient's infections and whose genetic makeup was known. They found three phages from Pittsburgh, Providence, Rhode Island, and Durban, South Africa. But only one of the matching phages would actually eliminate the infection. That is because while some phages reproduce within their bacteria hosts and then bust them open, others replicate with the bacteria without harming it, according to Robert Schooley, a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Disease at the University of California, San Diego, and a senior author on the case. The researchers used genetic engineering to remove a gene that prevents the phages from killing the bacteria, turning them into bacteria destroyers, says Graham Hatful, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Pittsburgh and a senior author on the paper. Dr. Spencer then administered the three-phage cocktail to the patient, both intravenously and directly applied to her skin in addition to a few antibiotics. The patient healed gradually over 6 months. The patient is still actively receiving both antibiotic and phage treatment to stave off the infection while otherwise living a relatively normal life, according to Dr. Spencer. From the Harvard Health letter, choosing an over-the-counter allergy medication. The options can be confusing. Try this approach when symptoms start to develop. If you're struggling with allergy symptoms, you may assume you can resolve them with an over-the-counter or OTC remedy, and that may be true. Many pharmaceutical-grade allergy drugs, once available only by prescription, are now as easy to buy as aspirin. But that development forces you to become a doctor in the drugstore aisle as you try to figure out which product is right for you. People often make the wrong decisions about which medication to take, and they wind up being undertreated. They try a mix of medications but don't get relief, says Dr. Ahmed Sedegat, an ear, nose, and throat specialist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary. What causes allergies? Before choosing a medication, it helps understand what's causing your allergies. Often it's a matter of inhaling a harmless substance, such as pollen or another allergen, which the immune system mistakenly perceives as a dangerous invader. The immune system then releases the hounds and generates substances designed to fight the assumed invader. One of these substances is histamine, which stimulates nerves in the nose to trigger sneezing. Histamine also causes the nasal passages to fill with fluid and cells that can fight invaders. The result, inflamed mucous membranes and the production of mucus, lots of it. This condition, called allergic rhinitis, is marked by a stuffy or runny nose, watery or itchy eyes, sneezing, coughing, and sometimes a sore throat. Strategies to fight back. There are two primary ways that over-the-counter drugs help you manage allergies. One is by blocking the effects of histamine when the alarm bells sound. To do this, you can use a medicine called an antihistamine, such as diphenhydramine or Benadryl or loratadine Claritin. Another way, says Dr. Sedegat, is by suppressing the immune system response before it even releases histamine. This is done with corticosteroid nasal sprays. OTC versions include Rhinocort, Flonase, and Nasacort. Sometimes a combination of antihistamine and a corticosteroid nasal spray is the most effective treatment. Using antihistamines, if you're experiencing what seems like your first reaction to an allergen from pollen, grasses, or weeds, maybe from a particularly potent pollen season, or if you're experiencing an isolated reaction to a day of yard work, Dr. Sedegat recommends trying an antihistamine for quick relief. But be careful. First-generation over-the-counter antihistamines such as chlortrimeton and Benadryl can cause drowsiness and confusion in some people, which can also lead to falls. Instead, Dr. Sedegat suggests taking a second-generation OTC antihistamine that's less likely to cause drowsiness, such as Allegra or Zyrtec. Compared with first-generation antihistamines, the second-generation ones are no more potent, but they are more expensive. Antihistamine eye drops, such as Zatator, available over-the-counter, can be used for watery eyes. Using corticosteroids, if an antihistamine isn't resolving your symptoms, or if you know you'll have an allergic reaction to a particular season, such as tree pollens are bothersome in the spring, grasses can be a problem in early summer, and ragweed is an offender in the late summer and fall, you may want to up your game by using a corticosteroid nasal spray. Head-to-head, the corticosteroid nasal sprays work better than oral antihistamines for congestion and stuffy nose. The downside is that these sprays take time, usually at least 2 to 4 weeks, for their full effect. That can be tough when you're coping with symptoms. If you anticipate seasonal allergy symptoms, you'll need to start using the corticosteroid nasal spray before symptoms typically begin. But nasal corticosteroids also have side effects. They can cause bloody noses, they can worsen glaucoma, and in rare cases, they can cause a hole in the septum, the wall that separates the right and left side of the nose. When to see a doctor? Dr. Sedigat recommends trying out OTC remedies to treat allergy symptoms for a month. If you're still having symptoms, or if you're concerned about side effects, it may be time to consult your primary care physician, an allergist, or an ear, nose, and throat specialist. All of these medications can be tweaked in terms of how much you take and how often. But remember, it takes an expert to know how much and which kind of drug will be safe for your particular health condition and how it will interact with your other medications. Another option, moving to prescription allergy drugs, prescription antihistamine sprays such as Astilin, Pantenace, may help prevent the symptoms of sneezing and a runny nose while minimizing drowsiness. Doctors can also add another type of prescription medication to your regimen called a leukotriene inhibitor. These drugs, such as Singulair, Accolate, and Xyflo, block inflammatory chemicals called leukotrienes. Final thoughts. Sometimes it takes trial and error to find the best combination of medications to relieve your symptoms, and if nothing is controlling them, there are still more options, including allergy shots that can change how your immune system responds to allergens, which is a therapy that takes months to kick in and years to maintain. But Dr. Sedigat recommends trying more conservative treatments first. We have great success with the standard approach of antihistamines and corticosteroid nasal sprays, he says. For many people, that's all it takes to breathe easier and eliminate the symptoms of allergic rhinitis. For more information, check out the Harvard Special Health Report called Controlling Your Allergies at www.health.harvard.edu/all. What about decongestants? Over-the-counter decongestants such as Sudafed or neosinephrine, Sudafed PE, narrow the blood vessels, which can help reduce inflammation in your nasal passages and provide relief. But older adults can be more sensitive to the effects of these medications, so it's important to check with your doctor before using them. What's the problem? For one, decongestants can increase your blood pressure. Decongestants are also stimulants, which can increase your heart rate or cause anxiety or insomnia. The drugs aren't recommended for people with heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, or angina. Using over-the-counter decongestant nasal sprays for more than 2 or 3 days can backfire, leading to greater swelling than you experienced initially. News briefs. Long-term exercise programs linked to reduce fall risk. You probably know that exercise can help you maintain your balance and prevent falls, which are among the top causes of injury and death among older adults. But if you're worried that being active will wind up increasing your risk of getting hurt, a large study may put your fears to rest. The research published online December 28, 2018 by JAMA Internal Medicine analyzed 40 randomized trials that included about 22,000 older adults. People who exercised for 1 year or more had a 12% relative reduction in falls and a 26% relative reduction in falls with injury compared with people who didn't exercise. Also, exercising long-term was not associated with an increase in the rate of hospitalization or death, though it wasn't linked to a reduction either. Researchers didn't determine which kind of exercise was best. However, the most benefits were seen when people exercised 3 times a week, 50 minutes per session, in programs that included several components such as balance exercises, strength training for the lower limbs, and aerobic exercise, the kind that gets your heart and lungs pumping, like brisk walking. Medications we're watching. 3 newly approved medications are garnering national attention. The first is an oral form of a powerful opioid painkiller that's been available by injection since 1984. Dysuvia, D-S-U-V-I-A, is the sublingual sublingual under the tongue version of sufentanil, and it was approved by the FDA in November 2018. Dysuvia is 1,000 times more potent than morphine. The FDA says it may be helpful for use on the battlefield or in hospitals. Critics worry the drug will wind up in the streets, furthering the country's opioid crisis. Another medication of note is the first prescription drug made from marijuana. The FDA approved cannabidiol or epidiolex, E-P-I-D-I-O-L-E-X, epidiolex, I guess is how you pronounce it, epidiolex, in June 2018 for the treatment of seizures associated with rare forms of epilepsy. The medication is made from a component of marijuana that does not cause intoxication or euphoria. And finally, Xofluza, X-O-F-L-U-Z-A, the first new antiviral in 20 years to help fight the flu, received FDA clearance in October 2018. The drug is a one-dose pill that may help shorten the duration of the flu if it's taken within 48 hours of the start of symptoms. One caution, the new antiviral has not been tested in older adults, so talk to your doctor if the drug is prescribed and if you have concerns. Coffee tied to decreased rosacea risk. For some people, it's tough to prevent flare-ups of rosacea, the reddened and sometimes bumpy skin that shows up on the cheeks, nose, and other areas of the face. Caffeine, heat, sun exposure, and a long list of foods, everything from spicy foods to yogurt, have been thought to trigger rosacea or make it worse. But a study published online October 17, 2018 by JAMA Dermatology not only pokes a hole in the idea that caffeine is to blame, it also suggests that one major caffeine source, coffee, might even reduce the risk of rosacea. Researchers analyzed health and diet survey responses gathered every 4 years from nearly 83,000 women, most of whom were white, from 1991 to 2005. It turns out that women who drank four or more cups of caffeinated coffee per day were 23% less likely to report a diagnosis of rosacea during the study period, compared with women who drank less than one cup per month. Increased caffeine intake from tea, soda, and chocolate had no impact on the likelihood of developing rosacea. The study was only observational and can't prove cause and effect, but coffee has also been linked to many other health benefits, including lower blood pressure, a slower rate of weight gain with age, and reduced risk for developing type 2 diabetes. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading it for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.